From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. On today's program, the president gives Congress an ultimatum about climate change.
If Congress won't act soon to protect future generations, I will.
We'll talk to a scientist about what's happening to Michigan because of climate change and what to expect from the government. And the Syrian conflict seems distant to most of us, but one of the opposition leaders lives here in Michigan, one of the few women within the effort to overturn the Assad regime.
This is the beginning, and if we're looking for the beginning of a new free and democratic Syria, then women need to be on the political table as well.
We'll also hear from a nationally recognized teacher about how to make the classroom work and keep the best teachers.
It's really no wonder that the retention of educators is tough.
That and much more coming up, but first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. On today's show, we continue our look at how to make teachers more accountable here in Michigan. We speak with a former teacher with 18 years of experience in the classroom about what changes he'd like to see in terms of teacher effectiveness and preparation. And Detroit Mayor Bing delivers his State of the City address tonight. We'll get the latest on what to expect. Plus, we talk to a Syrian opposition leader here in Michigan. She shares her view on what it will take to overturn the Assad regime. So, did you watch a certain college basketball game last night, or did you watch President Obama's State of the Union address? You can call me a policy wonk, but I watched the speech. It was budget and sequester and deficit and jobs, but just like in his inaugural address, the president talked about global warming.
But for the sake of our children and our future, we must do more to combat climate change.
He chided Congress to recognize the science was overwhelming and it's time to do something or else.
I urge this Congress to get together, pursue a bipartisan, market-based solution to climate change, like the one John McCain and Joe Lieberman worked on together a few years ago. But if Congress won't act soon to protect future generations, I will. I will direct my cabinet to come up with executive actions we can take now and in the future to reduce pollution, prepare our communities for the consequences of climate change, and speed the transition to more sustainable sources of energy.
Part of the reason President Obama is so insistent that the U.S. government do something is a recent report on how climate is changing in the U.S. and the world, how it's affecting crops, causing damaging weather, and doing some different things to the Great Lakes, and a lot more. Don Scavia is a convening lead author of the National Climate Assessment. He's also the director of the Graham Sustainability Institute at the University of Michigan, and he joins us now. So, Dr. Scavia, it seems the president is bent on taking action. What was your reaction to his more or less ultimatum to Congress last night?
Well, I watched that. I'm glad I didn't watch the basketball game as well. I was pleased, in fact, wondering what's taken so long. I was really happy to see that the president has finally raised climate change to near the top of the policy agenda. It's about time. The science has been overwhelming for quite a long time, so I was very happy to hear that speech.
Now, the Environment Report's Rebecca Williams talked to you when the National Climate Assessment was first drafted. She talked to you about some of the impacts we're likely to expect in the Midwest. Can you give us a quick summary?
Sure. So temperatures are going to be continuing to increase. It's sort of interesting to know that over the past decades, the temperature in this region has increased, but it's increasing at a faster rate in the last couple of decades, and we're expecting that to continue into the future. What also has been happening in the region, and what we expect to happen even more, is that our rain is coming in more intense spring storms, and we're seeing longer, more intense droughts during the summer. This is what's been already happening in the region, and it's going to be happening even more under a warmer climate.
We heard a report this morning that the fruit trees, could be facing a harder time because of climate change, because of this erratic freeze-thaw cycle at the beginning of spring, late winter. Is that part of climate change, or is this just a cycle, as some people believe?
Well, I mean, what we've seen in the past several years, and what I think the models are projecting, is that there will be this continued warming, which we'll be getting sort of early onset of the blooms, but we're not going to get rid of the cold outbreaks. And so, like has happened in the last several years, the fruit trees will begin to bloom early on, much earlier than they would normally do. A cold snap would then destroy the crop, as it has happened. You know, that condition is something that people used to expect once or twice in a lifetime. We're now seeing it every few years, which is an indication that we're heading into a new era.
So what do you expect to happen next? Quick action by Congress or the Obama administration rolling out some new programs? And if either way, what might those programs be?
Well, one would hope that Congress would take this seriously and put together a program that would harness the strength of the industry and the strength of the market to do things in more efficient ways and to stimulate the economy. If that doesn't happen, then I do hope that the administration does follow through and start taking more actions like they have in the recent past with dealing with emissions from coal-fired power plants, maybe even increasing the fuel efficiency standards in our cars. You know, one of the things that's so important to keep in mind is that the kinds of actions that we need to take to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions are also the same kinds of actions we need to take to improve human health. And so I think moving smartly in those directions would be really important for the administration if the Congress doesn't act soon enough.
It really makes business sense. It's more efficient. And, in fact, we've seen some corporations adhering to more of these efficiency plans just simply because it's good for the bottom line.
It sure is. If you can do things more efficiently, you can save money. I also believe that if we are to do this in a smart way that provide incentives in the right places, we can grow manufacturing in the region as well. We need to be developing the kinds of technologies that will be producing the more efficient energy in the future and the more reliable, renewable energy.
Don Scavia is the director of the Graham Sustainability Institute at the University of Michigan and one of the lead authors of the third National Climate Assessment. Thank you, Dr. Scavia.
Thank you.
From the State of the Union to the State of Detroit. Tonight, Mayor Bing delivers his fourth State of the City address, and it's not expected to be your normal outline of the city's future. Detroit has cut pay of city workers. It's trying to save money through furlough days. It's trying to make a lot of other cuts. But it's still not cutting enough to avoid a deficit of hundreds of millions for the year. And on top of that, there are billions of dollars in unfunded liabilities. The governor is interviewing potential financial managers in anticipation of a review that might recommend the state take over Detroit's finances. With us to talk about Detroit's immediate future are Jack Lessenberry, the senior political analyst here at Michigan Radio, and Daniel Howes, a columnist with the Detroit News. First, Daniel, you wrote in a January 3rd column, "The city is out of time and options, a stark realization that took way too long to arrive at the council table." What do you expect to hear from Mayor Bing tonight that might address that realization?
Well, I certainly expect to hear him talk about the things that they have done so far, the things you've mentioned, the furloughs. But they've got a mountain of liabilities that they are not going to be able to outrun, at least under the current scenario. I think this mayor is out of gas, frankly. There's a lot of speculation about whether he will or will not run for another term, and I think more and more people think that he won't. And I don't think there's any question also that the governor is getting very close to naming an emergency manager. Now, I know there's going to be a pretty fierce political reaction to that in Detroit, understandably, but I think it is looking increasingly inevitable. And, you know, I noted yesterday and posted on my blog a comment that Charles Pugh, the president of the council, suggested that they create a working group to study options for Belle Isle. And as you probably know, Belle Isle has been that deal has been pulled off the table by the governor. And I think it's just very indicative of a level of cluelessness about the situation that this city is in financially. And it's not going to get a lot better in the near term. They've got to go. They've got a bunch of consultants who are working inside the city right now. And from what I understand, they are finding all sorts of examples of bad management, a lot of, quote, money laying around. And what I mean by that is potential savings if it's managed properly. I think when the story is told about what's happened to Detroit, it's going to be a story of gross mismanagement by a number of administrations.
Detroit officials still say they can make the cuts that are necessary to convince state leaders that an emergency manager is not necessary. How realistic is that?
I don't think it really is. you know, they have got to move with a lot more dispatch. The financial advisory board that's been appointed by the governor and the mayor is telling them they're not moving quickly enough. And I think that's part of any political process. That doesn't have to be in Detroit. It could be in Washington. It could be in Lansing. It can be in a lot of different places. Political systems are not made to move quickly. They're built on consensus, on horse trading, and various other things. Whereas in a corporate environment, you can move a lot more quickly. And I think what this town has become accustomed to, based on what we went through in 2008 and 2009 and even 2010 with the auto industry, is that when a few people put their minds to it, they move very quickly, particularly when what's in the distance is the figurative gallows for a company. That is also the case, I think, for the city of Detroit, but it's not moving in the same with the same speed and the same alacrity, and I don't think it necessarily will.
Jack Lesenberry, if Detroit is facing a financial takeover or bankruptcy, it would seem no matter what Mayor Bing says tonight, it's not going to be enough. How much influence will he actually have on the future of the city?
I think there's kind of a poignancy here, and this is likely to be the last State of the City address by sort of a mayor under quote-unquote normal conditions for some time to come. Dan House is exactly right. I think the decision to appoint an emergency manager was made some time ago, certainly after the Belle Isle fiasco, but I think you'd have had one even if City Council had voted to have the state run Belle Isle as a state park. Mm-hmm. I sort of have some sympathy for Mayor Bing. This fellow was, for 20 years, people asked him, they said, you have to run for mayor to save the city. He finally agreed to. He came in after Kwame Kilpatrick. He told me 6 months after being mayor, I spent an hour with him. He said the budget figures that he was dealing with were all fictitious, that it was just sort of a mayor's nest, a nightmare. And I don't know that anybody, I don't think that Mayor Bing has been the most effectual mayor, or he certainly never built a working relationship with city council, although I don't know who could with this city council. But I think that he tried. And I think the problems were so insurmountable. You raise a good question. Will the emergency manager, when he or she comes, consult with Mayor Bing? They don't have to. They probably would be well advised to, but he will still be in power at least till the end of the year if he doesn't run again. And I'm convinced he won't run again, but he will be largely a figurehead, as will the council people. And so this is kind of like, you know, this reminds me in a way of the last days of the Soviet Union, when everybody knew it was going to dissolve and poor Mikhail Gorbachev was trying to sort of, you know, keep government running at some level. I think that nobody has any real doubt that emergency manager is coming probably within the next month.
We'll continue our conversation about Detroit's immediate future when we come back. And one Syrian opposition leader here in Michigan shares her view on what it will take to overturn the Assad regime. And that story comes up in 15 minutes here on Stateside. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. We've been speaking with Jack Lesenberry, the senior political analyst here at Michigan Radio, and Daniel Howes, a columnist with the Detroit News, about Detroit's future as Mayor Dave Bing is set to deliver his fourth State of the City address and possibly his last. Now, you both mentioned Belle Isle earlier. For years now, it appears patience in Lansing for Detroit's financial struggles has run out. The failure to arrive at a deal for the state to help revitalize Belle Isle seems to have been the last straw among Lansing legislators. If I'm reading that right, is a state takeover of Detroit's finances inevitable?
Yes, I do think it is inevitable, and a lot of people say, well, they should go to bankruptcy. Well, under state law, they can't go to bankruptcy until there is an emergency manager. So the emergency manager is the person that would recommend to the governor, I can't get this done. I need the help of the federal courts. I don't think we're going to go there, although the Snyder administration, as I reported about a month ago or 6 weeks ago, has been working on contingency plans to take the city into Chapter 9 bankruptcy and ways in which they would do that. Now, the city hasn't done any of that. It's refused to talk to bankruptcy counsel. It's very analogous to General Motors in 2008. We're not going to go there. We're not going to prepare for it, which is a dereliction of duty in a sense. But politically, I can understand why they would say that. But yes, I do think that you're ultimately going to get there. You cannot continue to kick this can down the road and continue to run these finances. You can't issue more debt. The reality is that at some point in this process, taxpayers of the state of Michigan are going to be backing the financial bailout of Detroit, because they're going to have to somehow raise some kind of money to finance the restructuring. And that happens in any case. In a bankruptcy, you get a consortium of banks that are going to lend to a company. And in this case, somehow they're going to have to raise cash. And that money is going to be backed by one of two things, either revenue bonds from the city or in some way some kind of – there are various programs within the state. They can't issue general obligation bonds for the taxpayers of Michigan, but there are certain programs that they have. But all of those are pretty small. I've done some reporting on this. And as a result, I don't think they'd be very effective for Detroit, which I think then gets you back to an emergency manager who has to really go through and start to do things. That Belle Isle deal will be done in a nanosecond by an emergency manager.
Yeah, and it's still in the governor's budget.
Right. And there will be a number of other things that will be done very, very quickly to start to go right after a lot of that low-hanging fruit.
Let's assume for a second that the financial manager does come in. If the things are so badly mismanaged and so messed up and the books just aren't right, can that be fixed? I mean, can someone that good be found to come in and say, all right, this is how we're going to do it? Or is it going to be beyond even the best of financial managers to fix Detroit's financial issues?
Well, I would say, you know, he's got that manager is going to have a number of groups that are helping him or her assess what the situation is. These are people that specialize in these kinds of workouts and you know, forensic accounting and other kind of management groups. So he's not going to be doing this alone. And yeah, I think you can ultimately get to the bottom of it, but it takes time. Again, this is a rough analogy, but in the case of General Motors in 2008 and 2009, and even into early 2010, they did not know how much cash they had from one month to the next. And if you ask the financial people, they couldn't tell you. They could guess, but they really couldn't tell you. So one of the big things that they had to do over 12 to 18 to 24 months was to get a financial accounting system that was robust and knew what was going on across the company and around the world. This is a much smaller kind of thing. It can be done, but it takes robust management systems. It takes smart IT, and it takes the use of technology to do that. That takes money and time.
Jack, anybody who's been to a city council meeting knows that they can be pretty raucous. I'm wondering what you think the people of Detroit will think about the state coming in with a financial manager and taking over their city.
There's a misperception, I think, spread by the media. There's a group of people. I was talking to Steve Henderson, who's the editorial page editor of the Free Press, about this yesterday. There's a group of rabble-rousers, gadflies in every city. And 10 years ago, we were seeing the same people at school board meetings that now come to the city council meetings. And those people will yell and scream. But I don't know that I think they're not representative of the vast majority of the citizens. I think the real interesting thing is I don't anticipate. I think there's some fear on some parts of some people. There'd be some kind of civil disturbance when an emergency manager comes. I don't think there's any threat of that at all. I mean, there'll be people yell and scream and bounce up and down, but not very many of those. I think the real interesting thing is, sure, an emergency manager can straighten out the books and rationalize procedures, and the current slang term is haircut, you know, cut, especially after they get new powers. Now, remember, they're going to get broad new powers at the end of March because of the bill that was passed in lame duck session. But let's say you have an emergency manager that leads the city through bankruptcy. It's not like some poor, disreputable journalist like you or I or Dan going through bankruptcy and, you know, we losing our credit rating but keeping our home. This is going to be devastating to many thousands of people who thought they were going to get pensions and other people who are owed money by the city. But then when General Motors went through this process of a cushion bankruptcy, at the end of the day, when it was all over, General Motors had a product it could sell that people wanted to buy, its cars. It's not clear to me how Detroit is going to proceed in the future, even if it starts over square zero, gets its debts out of the way. How does Detroit become a viable community that can attack the broad base of, you know, middle-class people, and that's something nobody's even thinking about at this point, but which we need to.
Okay, given everything we've said and talked about, what's the one thing you want to hear from Mayor Bing tonight in his State of the City address? Daniel?
A realistic assessment of where they are. I don't think you're going to hear it. I think he's going to dress it up a lot. But I think the points that Jack makes are very true. And, you know, they don't have a product to sell. But I think the first step, to borrow another automotive analogy, is more like the Ford Motor Company thing where you have to match demand to production. And Detroit's case, you have to really match their spending to what the revenue they're bringing in. I mean, you got to do this in steps. This is a process. Detroit's evolution is a process. It's not, we're not going to wake up in 2 years and we're going to be, you know, North Michigan Avenue in Chicago. That's not how it's going to work. This is a process, and I think them getting their finances right. And the other thing we haven't talked about that I think is critically important is we're likely a year from now, we'll be sitting here, we're going to have a new mayor and an all-new council elected for the first time since 1918 to represent districts in the city of Detroit. I think that could be a very different political dynamic.
Jack, what's one thing you'd like to hear from Mayor Bing tonight?
Well, it's not a perfect analogy, but at the end of the World War II, the Japanese emperor came on the radio and said, "We have to prepare to bear the unbearable and endure the unendurable." I think the mayor would be well advised to say that something like, you know, Detroiters are strong, they've gone through tough times, tougher times ahead, and we may have to, you know, stomach things we don't really want to, but we'll get through all this. Prepare people for the inevitability of what is coming. The worst thing possibly could do is give some sort of pugnacious, defiant, Kwame Kilpatrick or Joanne Watson like, "We're not going to do this, we're not going to," and that would just make things bad. But I don't think Mayor Bing is like that. I think he's very realistic, and he needs to sort of prepare people, be realistic, as Dan said, but prepare people for the knowledge that harder times are coming.
Jack Lesenberry is senior political analyst for Michigan Radio. Daniel House is a columnist with the Detroit News. Gentlemen, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
During President Obama's State of the Union address last night, he talked about the Arab Spring and the ongoing changes in the Middle East. And then he issued a warning to one country in particular.
"We'll keep the pressure on a Syrian regime that has murdered its own people and support opposition leaders that respect the rights of every Syrian."
One of those opposition leaders lives here in Michigan. The Syrian Americans in Michigan who are opposed to President Bashar Assad's regime are playing a key role in relief work in Syria and international efforts to end the Assad rule. Three groups have formed in Michigan in the last 2 years: the Syrian Sunrise Foundation in Franklin, the Syrian Expatriates Organization in Farmington Hills, now based in Washington, D.C., and United for a Free Syria in Flint. Muna Jondi is an immigration lawyer in Flint. She's president of United for a Free Syria, and recently became a member of the General Secretariat. That's the leadership group of the Syrian National Council, the main opposition group. Muna Jondi joins us now. Now, first, I want to ask you about the Syrian community in Michigan. A few months ago, I was in a Dearborn barbershop and talking to locals and ended up hearing from some pretty agitated guys who were calling media coverage of the Syrian conflict completely biased against the Assad government. It seems there's some disagreement within the Syrian community in Michigan about what's happening in Syria. So what's your take on that?
I think that there is still a population that supports the Assad regime within Syria and from without, even here in the United States. And, you know, I think that they look at it from the perspective of that what we know is better than that which we don't know. So the unknown of what's coming next, they basically, I think, err on the side of supporting something that they think is potentially less harmful than what would come next. Now, the reality, too, is that a lot of people view him as somebody who could have been a reformer, and that he potentially didn't have the opportunity to do the reforms that were needed, and that that could have been a better route. Now, of course, you know, my perspective is that he had the opportunity. He was president for 11 years, and even when the revolution began, he had that opportunity. And initially, people were calling for the reform of the regime before, you know, the killing started, and then they started calling for the fall of the regime. So I think that he's not the reformer that people still think that he could be.
The leadership of Syria's main opposition group in exile is an all-male affair. Elections failed to put even one woman on the General Secretariat, the leadership group within the Syrian National Council. You're a delegate on the council. What do you feel your role is in paving a path for women to leadership in Syrian opposition?
Well, I'll say a couple of things. One is I think that it's a disservice to say that it was just women who lost out in the elections. The way that the election process worked, there were actually some key individuals. The president himself of the Syrian National Council now, George Sabra, was not elected in those last elections. The now named ambassador, Dr. Munzer Mahos, in France, he was not elected either. And so there was a process when they looked after the elections. They said, OK, we've missed out some key people and we've definitely missed out on the women. And so then there was an attempt from the General Secretariat to say, OK, let's now elect some people that we think are key people that need to be involved. So women in the opposition, I would say, there's twofold. One is women in the revolution. Those of us on the outside that are in the political opposition or trying to support the revolution on the outside, women in particular, and, you know, the population in general, we're just helpers, you know. The real key are those in the revolution on the ground. And women have been involved from the get-go. You know, women participated in the protests initially. Women, you know, there's several women that have that were key in organizing protests. There's women who joined the Free Syrian Army. There's women in the political opposition. So women have been there since the beginning of the revolution.
So help me understand this. This exclusion of women from the General Secretariat, is this a matter of politics only or culture, a little of both? What's going on here?
I would say it's probably a little bit of both. But as a Syrian American, I know Syrian culture, and Syrian culture isn't like that about women. It's not an Afghanistan type of ideology at all. So I really think that they, you know, they immediately recognize it. And I actually, to be honest with you, was of the opinion that that's democracy. You know, if we didn't look at the process of the elections and who was on the slates and we didn't promote women or key individuals, then I was of the position, let democracy take its toll. And it was actually the men, many of the men that were saying, no, you know, that's unacceptable. And it wasn't that's unacceptable because the world is watching us. That's unacceptable because it's not a reflection of the reality of the revolution.
These are men within the General Secretariat.
Correct.
Or within the larger delegation?
Within the larger delegation and within the General Secretariat. So I don't feel like it was this, oh, you know, here, let's scramble and put them in and then shove them in a corner, you know, just so we can say that we have women. They did elect, the General Secretariat elected women. They decided that they wanted to have some women representation. So they said that we will elect three women. And I was one of the three that was elected to the General Secretariat.
So do you have a true voice? I mean, it's three out of what, 43
Correct.
Members?
I do have a voice. We have monthly meetings. We have email and Skype meetings. I believe that I'm heard and I don't see that I'm being heard, honestly, on any unequal level. You know, I think it's all about me asserting myself and not being intimidated by the fact that I'm in a room full of 40 other men, you know, and that I'm one of just, you know, three women. So I feel like I have to be more assertive in saying that I have to speak up sort of on behalf of my Syrian sisters.
Is there an awareness on your part that, you know, you're something of a role model for the opposition who are in exile and those who are in country fighting the battle? You're the role model for the women.
I'll be honest with you. I don't think that I'm really that much of a role model. I mean, the women on the inside, the women that are, you know, actively involved in the day-to-day revolution, they're the ones that are really sacrificing. Those of us on the outside, it's really a support. But I do recognize that this is the beginning. And if we're looking for the beginning of a new free and democratic Syria, then women need to be on the political table as well. So part of my decision when I was approached by some of my male counterparts and said, you know, listen, we want to nominate you for this position, I did take that into consideration, I'll be honest, because I think that there are other qualified, equally or more qualified women. But I thought to myself that I don't want to say no and then nobody else step up. And then this be a beginning of a bad trend politically for a new Syria.
It seems every day we hear of new atrocities in Syria. I think the death toll is estimated at something like 60,000 Syrians.
That's
right.
Correct.
Now, what would you like to see from the U.S. or Syria's neighbors or the United Nations? What should they do now?
I would like them to agree to a plan to end this regime. It's really just to me, I'm trying to wrap my mind around. We are in the 21st century, and a dictator is killing And I mean, the deaths are one thing. I'll be honest, the 60,000, there's 160,000 missing. There's 700,000 refugees. There's over 4 million internally displaced. This is the 21st century. How come the world isn't taking a stronger position to make this stop? I mean, it's not like we're just starting. This is, you know, it'll be 2 years next month that this began. So I feel that we're not taking a strong position. And I think that the U.S., despite the fact that we don't want to intervene in international issues as often, we are leaders. And we cannot deny that we are the superpower. And with that superpower status comes responsibility, and I don't think that we're living up to that responsibility.
Muna Jandi is president of the organization United for a Free Syria here in Michigan. She's also a member of the General Secretariat, the leadership group of the Syrian National Council, the main opposition group against the Assad regime. Thanks for talking with us about what's going on.
Thank you, Lester.
Here at Stateside, we want to connect with you. You can find us online at michiganradio.org, on Facebook, just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty, and on Twitter, at Stateside Radio. You can offer up your comments, you can suggest a story. Maybe you've got somebody in mind you'd like to see profiled on Stateside. Just contact us and let us know. Coming up, a teacher weighs in on what it takes to be a good educator. And dog sledding in Michigan. Get ready for the UP 200. That story coming up in 15 minutes. This is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Yesterday, we talked to a policy expert, a teacher educator, and a high school principal about how to hold teachers accountable and get them better prepared for the classroom. Today, we continue that conversation as we bring you an interview Cynthia Canty did with a nationally recognized teacher in the state.
As the Center for Michigan released its big report on public education in Michigan last month, the one called The Public's Agenda for Public Education, one of the major themes that emerged for discussion was how to evaluate teachers and how to better prepare teachers to do their jobs. So we wanted to bring a teacher into this discussion. Joining us now is Rob Stevenson. He taught elementary school for 18 years in Okemos. He's currently an administrator at Donnelly Elementary School in East Lansing. And by the way, Rob Stevenson was also one of the top five finalists for National Teacher of the Year in 2010. Thanks for joining us today, Rob.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Cindy.
Well, that report from the Center for Michigan took in the thoughts and opinions of people all over the state, and 4 out of 5 people say they really want Michigan's teachers to be better prepared for the classroom. So, in your view, what do you think, Rob, is missing when it comes to preparing teachers to stand in front of that classroom?
That's a great question. You know, part of it is the structure of how education is set up. One of the things I find most frustrating is the lack of collaboration that is really embedded within the profession. And, you know, if you look at studies and you look at effect sizes of what has profound impact on student achievement, it often comes down to teacher collaboration. And yet the structure really isn't set up to do that. Most of the time teachers work very independently within a silo structure within their own classroom. Rarely do they get an opportunity to observe one another, to collaborate. So when we start thinking about collaboration, that's a piece that's going to be missing as far as improving instruction. Other things that come to mind, of course, is going to be, you know, I was mentioning to someone the other day, I've supervised and mentored novice teachers coming out of 5 different Michigan prep institutions for teacher education. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I find fascinating is how often they lack the ability just to manage classrooms. Classroom management is an art. There's no doubt about it. You can ask any parent who has more than 2 kids.
Sure enough.
Just trying to manage behavior.
No, I get you because I had 1 week that lasted a year, 10 years ago when I taught vacation Bible school to the little ones going from kindergarten to first grade and walked out of that awful week for me with a huge, huge appreciation. What you said, an art.
It
how
is.
To manage all those little people.
Exactly. And what often happens is most teacher prep institutions, they do not have dedicated classes specifically for classroom management. And the intent is, or thinking is, well, they'll pick that up in their internship. But that is an erroneous assumption, because let's assume for a moment that you end up with a novice teacher getting in with a veteran teacher whose strong suit is not classroom management.
Mm.
Not only have we missed it in the teacher prep side, but they're not going to get the practical experience within the classroom. So that is another key ingredient that's missing. So again, I'll go back to collaboration, going back to classroom management. And there's another piece to this, though, because it starts shifting into the accountability piece. And I was alluding to the fact that we have this silo mentality. Mm-hmm. And teachers, they are accountable for their students. And I don't think any teacher is fearful of accountability. I really don't. The problem is when it becomes an accountability for just those students in front of you, as opposed to accountability to all the students within an institution of learning. And I like to view this as sort of a shared accountability, so that goals, individual professional goals, are all immersed in the work of your colleagues. So not only am I interested in how my students are doing, but how the students are doing in the classroom next door. If we can be investing in each other's students, there's a greater motivation to improve the quality of teaching that takes place around us, not just within our own room.
Well, are you saying then, Rob, you'd be in favor of let's take a look at how the entire school is doing? What about people who say, but doesn't that let maybe a substandard teacher hide a little bit or a lot behind data?
Actually, it doesn't, because here's where the pressure from colleagues weighs in. Because if you have a colleague that is bringing you down, you're invested to try to get them support that they need. And that's the other piece when we talk about accountability. I like to think in terms of our accountability piece as, okay, let's have shared goals, not just individual teacher goals from year to year, but let's have grade level goals or department goals in which we're trying to raise the standard of achievement, not just within a single room, but in multiple rooms. So there's this piece of it too. And let's be honest, when we start thinking about teacher prep and effective instruction, the most profound impact we have on student learning is the relationships that teachers foster with kids. And that relationship piece, it's not appreciated as much as it should be, that connection that we have with students and building a positive climate for learning.
And that's actually something that would be very hard to quantify and to measure.
It is, you know, but there are research studies that have been done, many of them, in fact, where you start looking at schools which are highly impoverished, dealing with many students of minority, and yet having these massive achievement gaps, and yet they're doing successful things to engage students and to turn their schools around. Models that are there that we can emulate from, and yet I don't think that actually takes place within teacher prep institutions either, as far as giving that research perspective and what can take place. You know, it's funny, I was interested in a study I read recently about the underserving of many minority students, and there was one research study that was talking about 4 out of 5 African-American children who are not given the opportunity to participate in enrichment or AP courses, even though they're qualified to do it. And it may be that the resources aren't there, or it may be because of unintended bias that happens to exist.
Yeah.
But these are all parts of the reality that we deal with in education that are something that we just need to confront, this idea of being culturally responsive and sensitive and using pedagogy that is going to differentiate for every single learner, with high expectations for every single student. But then, you know, the other piece of this, too, that many of these districts have experienced is it's really effective use of data. And, you know, we're in a state or a time of an abundance of data. And you've probably heard the expression, you know, data rich and information poor, the drip syndrome.
Yes.
You know, schools don't escape that either. We're surrounded and immersed in data, and yet if we don't use the information effectively, it's hard to really change our practice. So when I start thinking about the data that's out there and available to us, yes, we've got the summative data, and, you know, it's timely with the release of the MEEP data right now with our state summative assessments. But if we really want to be responsive to our learners, we have to be doing benchmark assessments throughout the year. We've got to be doing universal screening assessments. We've got to be doing regular progress monitoring and formative assessments. And so teachers can be responsive to that data and make wise decisions. Is this taking place in teacher prep institutions? I don't think so. The problem is at higher level, or higher ed, I should say, institutions, they're somewhat disconnected from current practice. And it's fine to be giving theory and what could be or what may have been in the past if some of these professors had been in the classroom. It's quite another to be thinking about the practical aspects of what's taking place in today's classroom.
Very much like training a physician, isn't it?
You know, I'm glad you gave that analogy, because I was talking about the collaboration piece previously,
yeah.
And, you know, I started thinking about the physician model and, you know, the rounds, mm-hmm. and, you know, you've got your physicians working together and collaborating to make good decisions, and we need to do the same thing in education. When you pool the collective expertise of many resources and personnel, you end up making a better decision in the long run.
It strikes me that when you talked about that silo effect, especially if you're a new teacher, so you're coming into that classroom and you have not yet developed that art of managing that classroom, you're not able to really plug in and get the wise advice or the mentoring of a more experienced teacher. You're really kind of out there all on your own.
Yeah, and you raise a good point with mentoring as well. You know, districts are required to provide mentoring, and yet I remember when I was first hired, I didn't even know I had a mentor until my third year.
Oh, boy.
I didn't know. And this person never reached out to me, and I never took advantage of it because I didn't even know. You know, you're so young, you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I got into this setting, and it's a missed opportunity. And with the demands that are placed on educators and the stress that accompany the position, it's really no wonder that the retention of educators is a tough, tough situation. I believe that something like 50% leave within the first 5 years. That's a very alarming rate, particularly when we're trying to attract the best and brightest to get into our classrooms to inspire our young children.
I'm curious, Rob, your thoughts. If you could talk to the parents of Michigan, the people listening now,
sure.
The ones who, in the conversations with the Center for Michigan, said, you know, 4 out of 5 want teachers to be better prepared.
Right.
2/3 want to see evaluation of teachers. What
right.
would you say to them? What don't they understand about what it is to be a teacher standing at the head of that classroom day in, day out?
First of all, I like the African proverb that it takes a village to raise a child, and I don't believe we can ever make the assumption that we can send kids off to school and fix them in isolation. It can't happen in isolation. It is a partnership, and I believe that it's a partnership between the home and the school, as well as the community at large, as well as businesses, as well as our legislature and policymakers. Everyone has to be invested in the same thing and commit. I've often had individuals who've come into my classroom, because I invite them in. It's easy to say, you know, to be critical when you've never walked in those shoes. And I remember inviting State Board of Education members into my classroom, and they came. And I remember inviting different legislators into my classroom, and they came. And honestly, being present within the instruction or in the environment, it changes perceptions a little bit. I would encourage families to get in touch with their schools to see how they can help, mm-hmm. rather than be critical. I also find it fascinating when you look at individual surveys that have been done. People will often be critical of schools in general, and then often when they're asked about their own school, their own home school, or their own child's teacher, it's usually very positive, which I always find fascinating.
Yeah.
Because they support it at the local level, but somehow when we start escalating to the big picture, the vantage changes, the perception change, the cynicism starts to sneak in. I find that a little bit sad. And, you know, much of this goes back to 1983 report when came out of Washington, D.C., and everyone was concerned about the state of education. And it's certainly a process of evolution as far as improvement, but to get there, it requires the collaborative efforts not only of educators, but of the community and society at large.
Rob Stevenson, thanks so much for sharing your insights with us today on Stateside.
It's my pleasure, Cindy. Thank you very much.
Rob Stevenson taught elementary school for 18 years in Okemos. He's currently an administrator at Donnelly Elementary in East Lansing and was also one of the top five finalists for National Teacher of the Year in 2010.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. You know, when winter hits the Great Lakes State, it's time to find some outdoor fun. Some of us think of downhill skiing, maybe snowboarding. Others hit the cross-country trails. And then there are the mushers, the men and women who hitch up their team of sled dogs, climb on the back of that sled, and strike out into the snowy trails. That's the opening moment of the UP 200, a major race in the world of mushing. The UP 200 happens this weekend. It covers 241 miles from Marquette to Grand Marais and back to Marquette.
Welcome to Grand Marais.
One of the mushers who's gearing up for this weekend's race is Al Hardman of Ludington. Al started running sled dogs in 1992 at the age of 50, and he's going strong at 70. Al Hardman takes a break from his training in the Upper Peninsula to join us on Stateside. So, Al, how's the training going for this weekend's race?
Pretty good. We've got quite a few miles, not as many as we'd like, because we had kind of a poor start this season. But the dogs look good. They seem to go fast enough for me, anyway.
Why a poor start? What, you talking about the sled, the musher, or the dogs, or the snow?
Well, the snow. We ended up with not as much snow early in the season, so we didn't get on sleds here until basically about the middle of January.
Now, I want to ask you about getting into this. As we mentioned, you didn't start this sport until you were 50. How'd you discover mushing? What'd you have to learn to be a decent musher?
Well, when I started off, I was probably the most nervous musher around. I had two Samoyeds that I trained to pull a sled, and we did a little camping. And then I went to a race. A local mush group had a three-dog race, so I went in that. And I guess I got bit by the bug and said, boy, if three dogs or two dogs can go this fast, you know, 10 dogs would be really good, you know. And then it just kind of snowballed after that.
This weekend you're doing this 240-mile race, and this is a qualifying run for the Iditarod, right?
That's correct, yeah.
And you've done this Iditarod four times? That's a 1,000-mile race.
That's correct, yes.
How long does it take to cover that?
Well, my best time was 10 days and 4 hours, and my worst was 13 days.
So what do you get out of this? What do you appreciate about racing?
That's a good question. That's one my wife asks me all the time. I guess it must be the challenge. I don't know what it really is, but you know, why do we do these things? You know, why do people climb Mount Everest? You know, I think it's just the challenge. You know, that you can keep doing stuff that you kind of like, and mushing is a lot of work, and there's kind of only really two really good times during the race, and that's when you leave the start line and when you get to the finish. In between, it's kind of up and down, you know?
I can imagine.
You know, lovely sunny day, you know, you see the scenery, and you think, man, this is great. Then you're in the middle of the night, in the middle of a blizzard, and not knowing if you're on the trail, and you're thinking, what am I doing this for?
We're all wishing you the right amount of snow and the right conditions for the race this weekend, the UP 200 in Marquette to Grand Marais and back. So good luck, and wish you well.
Okay, well, I appreciate it.
That's Al Hardman of Ludington. He'll be racing this weekend in the UP 200. Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. The program was engineered by Bob Skahn. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Maya Friedman, and Austin Davis. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Let's talk again tomorrow at 3:00.